From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we continue our week-long series of favorite music interviews from our archive with Jay-Z and Lizzo. Jay-Z grew up in a housing project in Brooklyn and sold drugs before finding success in music. He talks about his life and career and the danger of not writing down lyrics you just came up with.
I've lost a couple albums worth of great material. Well, I thought they were great.
Lizzo grew up thinking she'd be a professional classical flute player.
You know what's crazy? I always said flautist, and then one day someone's like, it's flutist. I'm like, shut up.
She talks about how she pivoted to pop and hip-hop, how Prince helped her growing up in the church, and making body positivity a theme in her work. First news.
pimpin', baby.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're continuing our series of favorite music interviews from our archive with Jay-Z and Lizzo. First, we have Jay-Z, who's been incredibly successful as a rapper and an entrepreneur. We spoke in 2010 after he published his memoir, Decoded, in which he wrote about growing up in a housing project and watching crack destroy his neighborhood. He sold drugs before finding success in the recording studio and on stage. His book also tells the stories behind 36 of his songs. He holds the record for the most number one albums by a solo artist on the Billboard 200. In 2017, Jay-Z became the first rapper to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. His 2009 record with Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind, became something of a New York anthem. He's also known as Beyoncé's husband. Let's start with one of Jay-Z's signature songs, Izzo, H-O-V-A, from his 2001 album, The Blueprint.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's put our hands together for this
dynasty.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the eighth wonder of the world, the flow of the century. Oh, it's timeless. Ho! Thanks for coming out tonight. You could have been anywhere in the world, but you're here with me. I appreciate that. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down in VA. Was herbing them in the home of the Turpins. Got it dirt cheap for them. Plus, if they were short with cheese, I would work with them. More than we got rid of that dirt for them. Wasn't born hustlers, I was birthing them. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For cheesy, my kneesy, keep my arms so breezy. Can't leave rap alone, the game needs me. Haters want me clap the chrome, it ain't easy. Cops wanna knock me, DA wanna box me in. But somehow, I beat them charges like Rocky. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. Not guilty, he who does not feel me is not real to me, therefore he doesn't exist. So poof, vamoose, son of a B. H to the Izzo, B to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down in VA. H to the Izzo, B to the Izze. That's the anthem, get your damn hands up. H to the Izzo.
Jay-Z, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on our show. So, what were your first rhymes like? You got your first boombox when you were 9. Your mother gave it to you, you say, because she thought it would help keep you out of trouble.
Just so, you know, if I was focusing on music, you know, I wouldn't be, running the streets all while. So she tried to encourage me to pursue my dreams in music early on. And my first rhymes were pretty much, you know, very boastful and, you know, academic, but they were kind of advanced for a young kid. Like, I put a piece of one of them, and it was like, I'm the king of hip-hop, the renewed like the Reebok, the key in the lock with words so provocative as long as I live. And I look back on that rhyme now, I'm like, man, it's pretty prophetic.
So you were about 9 when you wrote that?
Yeah, between 9 and 11, those are my first rhymes.
Okay, so provocative is a pretty big word for a kid of that age. You write how you started reading the dictionary, like looking for cool words to use. Did you find that word in the dictionary, or did you already know
it?
Yeah.
I found that in the dictionary. I had a sixth grade teacher, Miss Loudon, that was very pivotal to my hunger for wanting to know the English language and, you know, discover these words. And, you know, it was a tool in the music that in the poetry that I chose to pursue.
Would you describe the Marcy Projects in Bedford-Stuyvesant, where you grew up in Brooklyn?
Yeah, you have these three columns of buildings with 4 people on each floor, 6 floors. You know, so you have people to the left of you, right of you, top on top, and on the bottom of you. It's a very intense and stressful situation. Everyone's going through different things. And in between all that stress and angst and, you know, having to deal with one another in such close proximity, there's so much love. And there was playing in the Johnny Pump, and there was the ice cream man who coming around, and there was all these games that we play, and then it would turn suddenly just violent, and there'll be shootings at 12 in the afternoon on any given day. So it was just weird mix of emotions. I mean, you know, one day your best friend could be killed. The day before, you could be celebrating him getting a brand new bike. It's just extreme highs and lows.
How old were you when crack came to the neighborhood?
It was about 85, so I had to be a little earlier than that. So maybe about 12, 13 years old.
And how did that change the projects?
Well, I think what changed most was, you know, they have a saying, it takes a village to raise a child. It changed the authority figure because, you know, with crack cocaine, it was done so openly. The people who were addicted to it, the fiends, had very little self-respect for themselves. It was so highly addictive that they didn't care how they obtained it. And they carried that out in front of children who were dealing at the time. So the relationship of that respect of, you know, I have to respect my elders, and, you know, Uncle Tyrone's coming. He wasn't really your uncle, but he was the uncle for the neighborhood. And, you know, that dynamic shifted, and it had broke forever. And it just changed everything from that point on.
And it changed everything for you because you write about this in the book, and, you know, you've rapped about it too. You ended up being a hustler. You ended up selling crack and helping your mother as a single mother support the family. You describe in the book how when you first started writing rhymes, you had a notebook. But when you were hustling on the street, you weren't carrying your notebook with you. And if a rhyme came to you that you wanted to remember, what would you do? You'd go to the store. Tell the story how you'd go to the store to...
Yeah, what happened was I wrote so much in this book. I would sit at my table for hours and hours till my mother made me go to bed. And it was like this obsession with words and with writing. And as I got further away from that notebook, you know, as I was on the street and these ideas would come, I would run into the corner store, the bodega, and grab a paper bag or just buy juice, anything just to get a paper bag. And then I write the words on a paper bag and stuff these ideas in my pocket until I got back. Then I would transfer them into the notebook. And as I got further and further away from home and from the notebook, I had to memorize these rhymes longer and longer and longer. And like with any exercise, you know, once you train your brain to do that, it becomes a natural occurrence. So, you know, by the time I got to record my first album, which was I was 26, I didn't need pen to paper. My memory had been trained just to listen to a song, think of the words, and then just lay them to tape.
And what about now? Do you write down rhymes when they come to you? Or
no, I haven't since my first album.
And your memory's as good now as it was then?
Yeah. Yeah. I've lost plenty of material. It's not the best way. I wouldn't advise it to... I wouldn't advise it to anyone. I've lost a couple albums worth of great material. Well, I thought they were great when I couldn't remember them. You know, to think about how, you know, when you can't remember a word and it drives you crazy, like, man, I got to think about this. You know, it's the. So imagine, you know, forgetting an entire rhyme and having to sit there and like, what? I said I was the greatest something.
So what was the turning point in your life that got you out of hustling and into the recording studio?
It was like events that would happen over the years. You know, I went to a guy named Clark Kent, by the name of Clark Kent. I made a couple demos with him, and then I would leave back into the streets. You know, my cousin stopped speaking to me, thought I was wasting my talent, and I was like 1 foot in and 1 foot out. I always had in the back of my mind that I would be back in the streets for some reason, and I guess I didn't have 100% belief in what I was doing. Then finally I just said, man, I'm just going to give this music a try. I'm going to give it 100% and just forget everything that I'm doing. You know, and here we are.
We're listening to the interview I recorded with Jay-Z in 2010. We'll hear more of the interview after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2010 interview with Jay-Z, recorded after the publication of his memoir, Decoded. Let's talk about another one of your tracks. I want to play Hard Knock Life, which really surprised me when I first heard it because you sample the song Hard Knock Life from the Broadway show Annie, which I thought was a real surprise, surprising choice
to say the
for
least.
You. Yes, to say the least. So how did you decide to use that?
Well, what happened was my sister's name is Andrea Carter, and we call her Annie for short. So when the TV version of the play, you know, it came on, and it was like this a story called Annie, I was immediately drawn to it, of course, because it's my sister's name. Like, what is this about? So, I watched it, and I was immediately drawn to that story. And, you know, those words, instead of treated, we get tricked. Instead of kisses, we get kicked. It immediately resonated with me. So, you know, fast forward, I'm on the Puff Daddy tour, and I'm about to leave stage, and a DJ by the name of Kid Capri plays this track, no rap on it, just the instrumental. It stopped me in my tracks. It immediately brought me back to my childhood and that feeling. And I knew right then and there that I had to make that record and that, you know, people would relate to the struggle in it and the aspiration in it as well.
So let's hear the song and then we'll talk a little more about it. So this is Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by Jay-Z.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Let it bump though.
It's the hard knock life for us. It's the hard knock life for us. Steady treat us, we get kicked. Steady kisses, we get kicked. It's the hard knock life.
From standing on the corners bopping to driving some of the hottest cars New Yorkers ever seen. For dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard. From the dope spot with the smoke block cleaning the murder scene. You know me well from nightmares of a lonely cell. My only hell, but since when y'all know me to fail? Nah, we all my with the rubber grips or shots. And if you with me, mama, rubber your and whatnot. I'm from the school of the hard knocks. We must not let outsiders violate our blocks. And my plot is stick up the world and split it 50-50. Uh-huh, let's take the dough and stay real jiggy. Uh-huh, let's sip the Chris and get pissy-pissy. Flow infinitely like the memory of my Biggie. Baby, you know it's hell when I come through. The Life and Times of Sean Carter, Volume 2.
That's Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by my guest Jay-Z, who has a new book called Decoded. So you tell a great story in the book about how you got the rights to use that song, to use the song from Annie, Hard Knock Life. Would you tell the story?
Yeah. we got the rights already, so it's a bit late. So, because I exaggerated a touch. You know, in typical, when you have to clear a song, you have to send it, a sampled song, you send it to the original writers and they grant you permission and you pay a fee for that permission. You know, but some writers, their art is, for them, very important. So it has to be the right sort of attitude and the right take, and the emotion on the record has to fit, you know, what was originally intended. So we were having difficulties clearing the sample, and I wrote a letter about how much it meant to me, you know, what it meant to me growing up, and how I went to like a Broadway play, which was an exaggeration. I saw it on TV, and you know, we got the rights.
But let me stop
luckily.
You, because in the book you say that you told a big lie. In the book you say that you made up that you entered an essay contest, and in the essay you wrote about the importance of seeing Annie on Broadway, which you'd never seen on Broadway, in fact. And, you know, all that it meant to you when you saw it on Broadway. I think you said you, like, won the essay contest. And so you,
I didn't want you to put the whole thing out there. I was trying to, you know, I could have.
So in other words, you lied a little bit in order to get the rights.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a bad lie for a good reason.
Well, it worked out well for everybody.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question you might find weird, but since part of your goal in the book is to kind of explain your generation and explain the music to people. You know how a lot of hip-hop artists, when they're on stage, they kind of like grab their crotch?
Yeah, I have a great explanation for that.
Yeah, like how did that start? Like who started that and why is that?
Well, a lot of times in hip hop, like in rock and roll, you'll have bands who tour the world. They get in vans and they tour the world and they do rinky dink clubs and get bottles thrown at them and, you know, until they hone their craft, until they become, you know, rock stars. In hip hop, the music leads first. So you usually have a hit record and then you throw this person on stage who's never been on stage before, you know, because the music leads. So they don't have any experience on how to perform in front of people, hold the mic, you know, all these different things that you need to know as a performer. So when you get up there, you feel naked, right? So when you feel naked, what's the first thing you do? You cover yourself. So that bravado is an act of, I am so nervous right now, and I'm scared to death. I'm going to act so tough that I'm going to hide it, and I have to grab, you know, my crotch. That's just what happens.
I thought it was kind of the opposite, like, this stuff is so good. I'm going to show up.
That's
no?
What, yeah, they want you, that's what we want you to believe. But the reality is, and no one else will admit to this, maybe they will, is you're on stage in front of, people are getting put on stage in front of 50,000 people with a record that's a radio hit, and they've never performed before. It's going to be a disaster 9 times out of 10.
So do you feel like you were on stage before you prepared for it? Probably not, because you did parties before that. You had experience.
Exactly. I kind of went through a rock and roll stage. You know, I kind of was doing parties and learning to perform. The first show I ever did, I just forgot the words. I stood there and I tried to pass the mic to Damon Dash, who I co-founded Rockefeller with. I gave him the mic like, here. He was like, man, I don't rap. I just didn't know what to do. I was in shock.
So let's get another song in here, and let's do 99 sure. Problems. We'll do the clean version.
Ah,
it's radio, my friend. So this is actually based on a story, loosely based on a story that happened to you. Would you explain?
Well, it's based on a generational story as well. There's a higher thing. Like there was a time where. There was a lot of activity going on Turnpike from New York headed south because there was a lot of drugs going back and forth. And so the state troopers at that time just blanketed every single car, anybody that was of color. And it was this term, driving while black. And people were getting pulled over for absolutely no reason, you know, other than their color. So I just had to set the scene up. So now we're driving and we're actually doing something bad. You know, we're transporting drugs from New York to, you know, down south, and we get pulled over by a state trooper, but we get pulled over for absolutely nothing. We're wrong, the cop is wrong. This conversation ensues and it's racial undertones, and he says, Do you have a gun on you like a lot of you are? You know, just that statement right there. And the conversation between two people are both in the wrong, but are both used to getting their way. So there's this clever banter that goes back and forth between the two.
Okay, and we're going to hear the part of the song that deals with the story that you just told. And
yeah.
Again, it's the clean version, so a lot of the words are going to sound kind of...
It's the second verse.
Yeah. And I will say that one of the words that isn't clearly said here because it's distorted because it's the clean version is the word bitch, which in the context of this part of the song means dog, because you're talking about canine dogs here.
Yeah.
Because the canine,
and that was my and yeah. that was the writer in me being provocative, because that's what rap should be as well, you know, at times. That was really directed to all the people who hear buzzwords in rap music. They hear bitch or hoe or something and immediately dismiss everything else that, you know, takes place. And everything has to be put in context. And when you put it in context, you realize that I wasn't calling any female, besides a female dog, a bitch on this song.
You know, is that in spite of the opening part that says, if you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I've got 99 problems, but the bitch ain't one.
Yeah, that was to lead the listener down the wrong path if you were looking for that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's 99 Problems by my guest Jay-Z.
Hit me. Year's 94 and my trunk is raw. And my rear view mirror is the mother. Got two choices, y'all. Pull over the car or...
bounce on the devil, put the pedal to the floor. And I ain't trying to see no highway chase with Jake. Plus, I got a few dollars, I could fight the case. So I pull over to the side of the road, I heard. Son, do you know I'm stopping you for? Cause I'm young and I'm black and my hat's real low. Do I look like a mind reader, sir? I don't know. Am I under arrest or should I guess some more? Well, you was doing 55 in the 54. Uh-huh. Lost the registration and step out of the car. You carrying a weapon on you, I know a lot of you are. I ain't stepping out of though, my paper's legit. Well, do you mind if I look around the car a little bit? Well, my glove compartment is locked, so is the trunk in the back. And I know my rights, so you gon' need a warrant for that. Aren't you Sharp's attack? You some type of law or something, somebody important or something. I ain't past the bar, but I know a little bit enough that you wanna legally search my We'll see how smart you are when the K-9 comes. I got 99 problems, but a ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a ain't one. If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a ain't one. Hit me!
That was 99 Problems by my guest, Jay-Z. Do we have time for the other 98 problems?
No. Well, if you can get into 9 minutes.
My interview with Jay-Z was recorded in 2010. After a short break, we'll hear my 2019 interview with rapper, singer, and classically trained flute player, Lizzo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Best.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. And from DuckDuckGo, committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer internet privacy with one download. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified. At DuckDuckGo.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to continue our series of interviews with musicians from our archive with Lizzo. Her latest album, Special, was released earlier this year. The first single, About Damn Time, became her second song to hit number one. Lizzo spent years as an under-the-radar musician before rocketing to fame around the time of our 2019 interview. Her song Truth Hurts hit number one on the Billboard charts in 2019, about 2 years after its release. She's been nominated for 8 Grammys and won 3. Lizzo is a self-described big girl. Her backup dancers are big girls, too. Earlier this year, she hosted the Amazon Prime Video reality TV series called Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls, in which women competed to be her dancers. When she was in college, Lizzo was studying to become a classical flute player. Although hip-hop and pop won out, she's found a place for her flute in her music. Prince was a fan, and she recorded a track for his 2014 album Plectrum Electrum with Third Eye Girl. We spoke in 2019, just after Lizzo released her album 'Cause I Love You. We started with this track from that album, Juice.
Don't even gotta try.
Now you know.
I like shouting naked better over time.
Now you know.
They just say I'm not the baddest bitch you lie.
Lizzo, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your new album. Thank you so much for coming. I want to talk a little bit about the production on your album. It's so good, and there's different producers on different tracks. You're a constant on there, but you know, even though there's different producers for different tracks, the album has a kind of very coherent sensibility to it. Can you talk a little bit about the production and what your role is when deciding what the sound is going to be on each track?
Well, as some people may know, I am, you know, classically trained in music theory and music performance. So I have kind of an innate ear, and actually a highly skilled ear when it comes to frequency and harmony and dissonance and melody. And so it, for me, it's this thing that I can feel in my body. I'm almost like a tuning fork where if I hear the beat and I vibrate at the level that, you know, I'm supposed to, I know that that's what I want to get on. And from being trained, I think it's easier for me to speak a language to producers, and I can speak engineer to the engineers. And I think we all just have so much fun nerding out. And I'm credited as a producer on a couple of the songs because I was there, you know, and my DNA is in there as well.
So you play flute. And I'll just start by saying you've played flute like on TV and on videos. And a lot of people thought like, oh, it's dubbed by somebody else. She can't possibly play like that. She's not a classical person.
I don't know why people think that. That's racist.
Yes, you have some you have some very funny videos answering that. But yeah. Tell us how you started to play flute. Like, this was what, fifth or sixth grade? Did you choose the instrument, yeah, or did a teacher say, you get to play flute and this other person gets to play trombone?
Yeah, they chose. The flute chose me. I remember I was in band in fifth grade, and we were sitting down, and there was one girl, her name was Miss Johnson, and she was a flute specialist, but I really think she was, like, just going to college and was trying to get some extra credits, and he was like, Mr. Browden was like, who do you want in your flute class? Who do you want to play flute? And she picked me, and I don't know why she picked me. I think later on, she was like, you know, you just had a good embouchure. I could tell you'd have a good flute embouchure, which is, you know, your mouth. But I don't know. And I was, like, grateful because I wanted to play flute. I thought it was the coolest instrument. But, you know, who could have known? All the cool girls played clarinet anyway.
Well, how long was it until you started bringing your flute to gigs?
Well, I will say that I was playing the flute in my rock band when I first started playing shows, I played the flute, and I got nominated for Best Alternative Instrument in the Houston Press Awards for flute, and I would pull that little girl out and just start playing, and they would freak out. But I think it made more sense to bring it out in a progressive rock band. I didn't start bringing the flute out in my rap career until, at least for my solo career, way later. And I think it was like something that I did. So, for instance, my first tape ever, Lizzo Bangers, all of the flute on that album, which there's a lot of flute samples, I replayed because we couldn't clear the flute. So I had to actually replay the flute on those songs. So I've been playing flute on my projects forever, but no one knew it was me until now.
So how serious were you about a career as a flutist? Flautist?
I was flout. You know what's crazy? I always said flautist, and then one day someone's like, "It's flutist." I'm like, "Shut up!" But I was very, very, very serious. I studied flute. I played it every night. When I was a senior in high school or a junior, I started studying with the principal flutist of the Houston Opera. And she was also a professor at the University of Houston. So I was studying with Sydney Carlson for years, and she was kind of like priming me to go to U of H. She got me my scholarship to U of H. And then when I was studying with her there, she was setting me up to study at the Paris Conservatory.
Wow.
And I was going to study flute at the Paris Conservatory, and I was going to really just, you know, wait in line for that first chair. I saw a life of Concert Black and Boston Pops and traveling the world. And when that didn't pan out for me, I was very depressed. I was very sad. And I don't really know what happened. I think the pressure of those two worlds kind of got to me, because I was waking up every morning at like 6 a.m. for marching band at U of H. And then I would go to the rehearsal hall, and I would practice in this tiny room for hours, and then at night I would stay up and rap at fashion shows and try to stay up and keep up with all the fraternities and the sororities. And that was really taking a toll on me, and I was like, who are you? You know, at this point you could do it all through high school, but you're in college now. You're about to be who you're going to be forever, and now who is that?
So you grew up in Detroit. What music did you grow up with?
In Detroit, I grew up with a lot of gospel music. I remember we would listen to Perfecting Praises over and over and over. That was the Marvin Winans family album. And they would always come out with family albums, and we would just listen to that. Like, it was strictly gospel. I didn't really listen to secular music or, like, radio music. But mind you, I was still very, very young. But it shaped who I am today on stage. Like, you get a lot of hallelujah moments from me, and that's from Detroit and growing up in the Kojic Church.
Which church?
The Church of God in Christ, which is Kojic.
So when you weren't listening to secular music, was that because of the church? Did your parents not want secular music in the house?
I mean, well, you know, it was the devil. So we didn't. My parents, so the funny thing is, you know, my sister and my brother, who are older than me, they remember different things. Like, my dad, he really loved Elton John, and my mom loved Stevie Wonder. So, you know, we would have those types of things. Hall & Oates, you know, Queen. My dad loved Queen. So, like, those things would filter in here and there. But for the most part, you know, we tried to listen to gospel music. Music makes people feel things, and it made me feel things in church that I knew that I could bring to my music. You know what I'm trying to say? So, like, for instance, there was something about the way that the what's it called? It's like a revival song or shout music. Shout music is when the drummers are going off and the bass is like, doon, 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 you know, and then at that point, everybody's just running around the church and everyone's shouting. Like, that reaction, that visceral, physical reaction that you see in people that's driven by the music, like the pastor talking can make you say amen all day. But there's something about that driving music that makes you want to get out of your seat and run. And I knew that music had the power to move people physically, even emotionally, but especially physically. So I don't think it's just because we're talking about Jesus, because even in those bass lines, the bass line's not talking about Jesus. The bass line is just running and it takes you to God, or you know what I'm saying? It's just a vessel. And so I want to use my music as a vessel to get you where you need to go, to a positive place.
Okay, so I'm going to play a song that I think really gets you moving. The lyrics are very not spiritual, literally. They're more profane. and I want to play Boys.
Girl, what? This transition. All right, let's go.
It gets you moving. And in terms of believing in your music, I think this succeeds.
Yeah, I will say that this song live, out of all the other songs, get the people stomping. So if you ready to stomp,
okay,
there's Boys.
And I know it's quite a segue from what we're talking about, but I see it as connected. So this is Boys, and it was released first as a single, but it's an extra on the like expanded version of your new
deluxe
album, Because I Love You. The mm-hmm. deluxe version. Okay, so here's Lizzo.
What you say, boy? You tryna play coy like a game boy? Hit my phone, boy. Is your homeboy? Are you a lone boy? Come give me dome, boy. Got a boy with degrees, a boy in the streets, a boy on his knees, he a man in the sheets. Sheesh, it's all Greek to me. Got this boy speaking Spanish. I hit puppy. Baby, I don't need you. I just wanna freak you. I heard you a freak too. What's 2 + 2? Mississippi boys and the city boys. I like the pretty boys with the bow tie. Get your nails did, let it blow dry. I like a big beard, I like a clean face. I don't discriminate, come and get a taste. From the playboys to the gay boys, go and slay boys, you my fave boys.
Baby, I don't need you.
No, I don't need.
I just wanna freak you.
I want it,
yeah. I heard you a freak too.
That's right.
What's 2 + 2?
We'll hear more of my 2019 interview with Lizzo after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution to help businesses attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from Insperity, providing HR services for 30-plus years, including access to employee benefits and payroll. Insperity's mission is to help businesses succeed so communities prosper. Insperity. HR that makes a difference.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2019 interview with singer and hip-hop artist Lizzo. I know you met Prince when you were living in Minneapolis.
And I was on his album. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you did a track on the on one of his...
Plectrum Electrum.
On Plectrum mm-hmm. Electrum with Third Eyed Girl. And so how did he find you? Because he invited you to perform for him. He asked you then to do a track for Plectrum Electrum. So I know you when you moved to Minneapolis after college, after dropping out of college, you became a kind of important part of the music scene there. But so how did he find you? How did he hear you?
Okay, so... There was a
documentary being made about burgeoning musicians, and also, like, you know, yeah, I think it was just burgeoning musicians, actually, in Minnesota. And it was on one of the, like, local news stations, and it was us, me and my best friend and my DJ Sophia Aris' group, The Feeling, who won The Voice, and Plectrum Electrum, who is Prince's band, and I think some other people too, but I can't remember. And they did a piece on us, and the day it aired, the Current, the radio station in Minneapolis, called, and or St. Paul in Minneapolis, they called and said, they hit us up and said, yo, you won't believe this, but Prince just sent us an email asking for y'all's contact. And we were like, what? And mind you, this was maybe 2 years after I moved to Minneapolis. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, well, give them our email. What are you waiting for? And the email just simply said, I would like for you to come to Paisley Park on Easter Sunday. And
Easter Sunday, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty, it was amazing. And to work on a song, and we went, and it was magical. And from then on, we had a relationship with Paisley Park and with him, where we would just, he would ask us to come perform for his parties, and we would come and perform. And we also had, he, you know, talked about me in interviews. He was like, you know, Lizzo's one to watch. She's up next. When nobody was checking for me, he was checking for, you know, young black girls and young black artists, and giving us a voice, and gave me my first big check. I mean, I have a lot of respect and a deep, profound relationship with one of the greatest artists of all time. So that's all I can say about that.
Okay, so I want to break here and play another song. And this is from your 2016 EP, Coconut Oil, and the song is Good as Hell. I really love this. I know a lot of people do. Again, I'm going to ask you to talk about, you know, writing it and conceiving the sound.
Yeah. Good as Hell was the first time I had written a song that I was like, wow, this song could be on the radio. I never saw myself as, like, a big artist like that that would have, so I was very much indie minded, you know? And I remember it was one of the first songs I wrote with Ricky Reed, and we were in a studio, and he flew me out to LA, and I was like, oh, okay. I was like feeling myself. And we sat down and he played this piano riff, and he said, how does this make you feel? And I was like, you know how it makes me feel? And I did a little hair flip and I checked my nails. I was like, makes me feel like everything gonna be okay. You know, it's like, it makes me feel good as hell. And he was like, all right. And that was like the basis of our relationship. Like, he would literally take words from my mouth and be like, you know, you just wrote this lyric, right? And I was like, really? So this was the beginning of a very beautiful relationship.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Good as Hell from Lizzo's EP, Coconut Oil.
I do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
Good as hell.
Hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
Feeling good as hell.
Ooh, child, tired of the boo. Gone, dust your shoulders off. Keep it moving, yes, Lord. Trying to get some new in there, swimwear, going to the pool. Now come dry your eyes. You know you a star, you can touch the sky. I know that it's hard, but you have to try. If you need advice, let me simplify.
We'll hear more of my 2019 interview with Lizzo after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
That was a service.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with singer and musician Lizzo in 2019. So, you know, I read that when you were in, I guess, middle school, that there was a period when you used to, like, put plastic wrap around your tummy and around your feet to make them smaller, kind of like girdling them. Can you compare your mindset about yourself physically then to what it is now?
Okay, so I will say this. I would put plastic wrap around my stomach and I would walk and I would try to work out every morning in middle school and I would try to like lose all the fat off my stomach. But the shoe thing is real because my feet were so wide, I would make my shoes slouch and people would make fun of the fact that my shoes would slouch. Kids will make fun of anything, bro. Kids will find something about you. They would even make fun of the fact that your shirt had, like, nipples on it if it was on the hanger for too long. They'd be like, ah, you got s*** on your shoulders. So kids were so mean that it's wild, right? I would go out of my way to, I would tape my feet up because I read about it. I read that women in, like, Asia would bind their feet. And, you know, I'm in middle school reading about this, and I was like, I'm going to bind my feet so that my shoes don't slouch over, especially my new ones. And because I cared so much about what people thought because there was such a crazy consequence associated with being a little different. And I think that that consequence now is completely, it's the opposite. You know, now being different makes you stand out. Now being different makes you a star. And I think that I had to embrace those differences to become the person that I am, or, you know what I'm saying, the star that I am, or else I would have just been homogenized like everybody else. I think when you're in middle school and in high school, you want to be like everybody else. You want to amalgamize and you want to be normal so badly, but I just couldn't help being weird. I was so weird that people went out of their way to point it out for me. And now I'm so grateful for that.
I just want to ask you about one more song, and it's called My Skin. And I want you to talk about the song.
My Skin is a song that I wrote, and it was, I would like to say that this was the beginning of my body positive songwriting journey. I wrote it because someone asked a question. Someone asked a question. Hold on, Jesus. They asked me, what's my favorite thing about myself? And I told them my personality, and they said, okay, but physically, what's your favorite thing about yourself? And I did not have an answer. And for the first time in my life, I had to actually think about something that I liked about myself physically. And because it was so difficult, I was moved to tears. And in that moment, I remembered that, you know, I just fallen off a cliff. I was rope swinging into the river. And I am just so heavy. And the rope, I fell off the rope and fell on the ground. It was really scary and traumatizing. I'll never do anything like that again. But I scraped up my skin. And I remember my friend was like, look what you did to your beautiful skin. And I still had the cane and I had the bandages on my legs during this interview, and I looked down and I was like, oh my God, my skin, that is my favorite thing about myself. And it was in that moment where I realized I had damaged my skin, where I saw the value in it. And that was the first time I'd ever discovered my body love. And I just started with my skin and moved on from there. And I wrote this song to celebrate that moment because it literally changed my life.
Lizzo, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for your music.
Thank you.
My interview with Lizzo was recorded in 2019 after the release of her album, 'Cause I Love You. Her latest album, Special, was released earlier this year.
Yeah. Real world, big girl meets world. A crazy position, now your dreams is your mission, huh? Staring in the mirror, realizing wishing work. Now all I wish is for a chance to get my kids aboard. I got a family tree that's worth praising the Lord. Mama looking like the second, woo, look at God. Sister like a soldier, hold it down. Southwest gon' hold it down. I love you, don't forget it, your beautiful black masterpiece. Boy, they don't make brothers like you. Make it happen with that black girl magic, the hat trick off of what we do. I woke up in this,
Tomorrow on Fresh Air, as we continue our week-long series of interviews with musicians from our archive, we'll feature songwriter and singer Roseanne Cash. In 1973, when she was 18, her father, Johnny Cash, gave her a list of 100 essential country songs. I spoke with her in 2009 after she recorded 12 of those songs on her album, The List. I hope you'll join us.
Girl, I'm about to have a panic attack. I did the work, it didn't work. Truth, it hurts. Damn, it hurts. That lovey-dovey was not a fan of it. I'm good with my friends. I don't want a man, girl. I'm in my bed. I'm way too fine to be here alone. On other hand, I know my worth. And now he calling me. Why do I feel like this? What happened to me? Oh, oh, oh.
Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salat, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brugger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
How am I supposed to love somebody else when I don't like
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, dedicated to helping people secure their financial futures with lifetime retirement income. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution to help businesses attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one place. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.